Hello, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 19th. I'm Maggie from Drake University, and here is our first story. Bands vie for studio time. I'm comma mentor by Scott Stewart for the Nonpareil. A local band will win a chance to win a shot at that big break dreamed of by so many musicians. Pottawatomie Arts, Culture, and Entertainment teamed with Horseshoe Casino to host a fundraiser throughout April that will showcase the talent of local musicians. The Battle of the Bands starts April 4th at Whiskey Roadhouse, the performance venue inside Horseshoe Casino in Council Bluffs, according to a news release. Bands will compete each Thursday in April, going head-to-head with one advancing to the next round. A prize pool of $1,500 will be split among competing bands, according to a news release. Doors open at 7 p.m. for each show, which will begin at 8 p.m. Advancement decisions will be made by a panel of judges, including Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh and other local leaders, media personalities, and music industry professionals. The audience will be able to vote for their favorites by making donations to PACE. The final round will have a $10 admission charge, which will be donated to PACE. The bands are competing for a grand prize package that includes $1,500 in cash, the chance to play an opening gig at Harris Stir Cove Concert before a crowd of about 4,000 people, and 2 days of studio time at another recording company with music production by PACE studio artist Kent Hertz, an opportunity valued at $4,500. Hertz is a music producer and owner of HZ Productions, who has worked with musicians such as Beyoncé, Missy Elliott, and Lone Star, according to the release. Working with local bands and discovering new talent is incredibly rewarding, Hertz said in a release. I'm excited to be a part of this initiative to help elevate the music scene in our community while helping to raise funds for PACE. The deadline for bands to apply has passed, and the lineup will be announced March 28th. Funds collected through the Battle of the Bands will support PACE's efforts to ensure access to quality arts and culture programming in the community. PACE offers 400 classes and events each year, including theater, orchestra, children and adult art classes, children's camps, art gallery exhibitions, and community events such as Music in the Park. Stir Cove Concert has an electrifying season this year and will be hosting some of the biggest names in music, including the Beach Boys and Alabama. The winning band will open for a band with a similar genre to help them grow their fan base. The outdoor music venue always ensures great experiences and top-tier entertainment. We extend our heartfelt gratitude to the incredible team at Horseshoe Casino for their invaluable support in bringing this fundraiser to life, PACE CEO Dana Kem said in a release. Their dedication to supporting the arts in our community is wonderful, and giving local talent a chance to shine adds an exciting addition to our cultural scene. Our next story is Lawmakers Talk AEAs. Local representatives discuss how reform efforts could end in logjam by Scott Stewart for the Nonpareil. The pressure is continuing to build an Iowa legislature to resolve a trio of issues related to schools that's threatening to delay the end of the legislative season. Lawmakers previewed upcoming debates and discussed the outcome of last week's so-called second funnel, a deadline after which many bills are ruled ineligible for further consideration unless leadership uses special tools to bring them back, during an event hosted by the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce. State Senator Dan Dawson was joined by State Reps Brent Segrist and Josh Turek, participated in the public forum held at Wilson Middle School. Iowa House Majority Leader Matt Winchell was scheduled to attend, but Segrist said his colleague fell ill due to a bug that's been circulated in the state capitol in recent days. Lawmakers discussed at length their views on proposals to overhaul Iowa's system of area education agencies, which provide special education instruction and other services to school districts. Tax policy and other issues were also discussed at Saturday's event, and they will be covered in an article to appear in Thursday's Nonpareil. Turek, the only Democrat in the group of Council Bluffs lawmakers, called the AEA legislation a solution in search of a program, cautioning his fellow representatives to avoid throwing the baby out with the bathwater. He urged the Republican majority to consider an interim study of the AEAs. I'm not in support of any bill that would limit resources or support to the individuals with special needs, Turek said, noting that residents who have reached out to him have been unanimously in favor of maintaining Iowa's AEA system. Dawson said that he believes the AEAs have a valuable role to play, especially for rural schools, but he said they merit more scrutiny than they've been receiving. He called the House proposal a fine bill, and the Senate was debating its own AEA proposal as of Monday afternoon. "We do all need to come together in the end," Dawson said. The issue facing lawmakers is that the AEA reforms have become connected to a push to set the rate for state supplemental aid for schools, which is supposed to be done within the first 30 days of the session under Iowa code. School funding is a major component of the state budget, which lawmakers are also working on, and he said there's a significant difference between the current funding proposals. Separately, but not necessarily happening separately, Governor Kim Reynolds proposed raising the minimum wage paid to teachers as part of her AEA bill, which died in both chambers. The House passed a bill seeking to increase teacher and school support staff payments. That proposal is being considered alongside the school funding and AEA reforms, creating a three-pronged issue that Segrist and Dawson both said shouldn't be connected issues. Segrist said the House split the teacher pay and AEA issues and called the delay in setting school funding levels inexcusable. "The delay significantly complicates the budgeting process for local schools, which have to work off educated guesses about what lawmakers will do. We need to figure out a way through it," Segrist said. "SSA needs to be done as quickly as possible." Segrist is the former director of the Iowa Association of Area Education Agencies, and he said several of his colleagues have been following his lead when it comes to the AEA reform efforts. He was initially opposed, but he voted for the House bill, helping it clear the chamber. "This whole issue has already brought about some of the changes that people wanted to do, particularly concerning some of the administrative positions in the AEA system," Segrist said. The message has been heard pretty loud and clear. Segrist said his block votes could have taken that bill down, but he said that lawmakers need to do something about the AEA issue. "Otherwise, as I said on live TV, which wasn't one of my better moves, I said that if we don't, the governor is going to go on a rampage, which wasn't met particularly well in the governor's office," he said. "But what I meant is that she's really invested in this issue, and she's going to continue to talk about it. And when she's talking about it, in my opinion, she's trashing the AEAs unfairly because there's plenty of blame to go around." But Segrist said he's opposed to not having AEAs provide special education services. Other proposals would let schools be able to contract for those services with other providers. "In our bill, the funding would go to the school district, but they have to use the AEAs because that's who provides the best services," he said. He cited the profit motive getting in the way of managed care organizations helping to reform health care, comparing that to third-party providers of special education services. "I'm just saying right now, we could be here in July or August," Segrist said. "That's the bottom line. The House is not going to pass anything that changes the special education funding. There isn't 20 votes in the House to do that." Segrist said no amount of pressure will change that vote tally. "I've gone as far as I'll go," he said. "Hopefully we all come together very quickly." The image attached to the article shows State Senator Dan Dawson on the right while he talks with Josh Turek, far left, and State Representative Brent Segrist in the center as they listen to remarks during a Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce second 2024 legislative coffee at Wilson Middle School. On page A2, our third story of today is "Iowa Democrats Certify Results After Mail-In Low Turnout Presidential Caucuses" by Scott Stewart. The Iowa Democratic Party's State Central Committee voted to certify the results of the 2024 Iowa presidential caucuses on Saturday. President Joe Biden had an official tally of 12,337 votes, a little less than the average per game attendance this season for the Iowa Hawkeyes women's basketball program. Dean Phillips received support from 394 caucusgoers, while Marianne Williamson brought in 307 votes. Jason Palmer, the surprise winner of the caucuses in American Samoa, wasn't an official candidate in Iowa. 614 caucusgoers were uncommitted. IDP staff has worked hard over this year to make sure this year's presidential caucus was as accessible as possible, Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said in a news release. Pottawatomie County's caucus brought out 179 voters. 11 didn't choose Biden, 4 chose Phillips, 5 picked Williamson, and 2 were uncommitted. Mills County caucus Harris drew 40 voters, with 35 supporting Biden. Harrison County had 19 caucus goers, with 17 supporting Biden. And the image attached to the article showcases the small turnout of about 50 people who attended this year's Pottawatomie County Democratic Caucus at College View Elementary School on Monday, January 15th. On A3, our next article is Turnout Strong But Sober Wind Gusts by Tim Rower for the Nonpareil. High winds put somewhat of a hamper on Friday's glow into spring celebration at Tom Hannafin and River's Edge Park, but the turnout was still great for the inaugural springtime event. The City of Council Bluffs estimated a crowd of at least 10,000 people showed up. "We were overjoyed by the number of people who showed up," said Ashley Cruz, communications and event manager for the city. This event, intended to feature 7 hot air balloons tethered and illuminated as part of a bright, larger-than-life visual display, named to offer the public a unique and enjoyable outdoor experience along the local riverfront for the newly arrived season. Early on Friday morning, the forecast for that evening called for winds of 5 to 7 miles per hour, suitable for an event like that, Cruz told the Nonpareil. The pilots of those balloons, who were also monitoring the forecast, told the city it was a go with them, she added. When evening came, however, the winds increased to a steady 10 miles per hour, with gusts up to 15 miles per hour, Cruz said. Eventually, after a protracted delay, 2 balloons got upright after getting inflated, and their illumination delighted the remaining crowd. "Everybody went wild," Cruz said. Although the winds kept most of the balloons grounded, the event still offered plenty of things to enjoy, Cruz said. For example, many of the participants talked to the pilots, who explained how hot air balloons work. Numerous food trucks with a variety of menus saw brisk business, with local musician Joe Reynolds providing live acoustic music nearby. Several fire pits placed around the park were popular spots, while children ran around the park enjoying balloon animals and glow sticks. Some people even brought picnic baskets, Cruz said. The event was also a chance for the city to show its support for the cycling community and to encourage all residents to utilize the local trail system for recreation and transportation. The city partnered with Heartland Bike Share for providing additional on-site bike parking at the event and gave out special t-shirts to the first 100 people who rode their bikes there using city trails. "That was a huge hit," Cruz said. "Those 100 t-shirts were gone by 6:30 p.m., which is when the event started." The bicyclists helped with the traffic, but congestion remained a problem for many motorists, with the city ending up the victim of its own success. Comments about parking and traffic will prompt event planners to have the Council Bluffs Police Department communicate more on social media about the procedures for upcoming large gatherings, Cruz said. They will also help with traffic control, Cruz added. On Friday evening, a nearby parking garage and the adjacent surface lot by the park were completely empty of vehicles by 10 p.m. "More restrooms will be installed for future events," she said. Some spectators who came to see all of the balloons lit up took the windy situation in stride, including Mary Gum of Council Bluffs. "I'm a little disappointed because I wanted to see it," Gum said, "but it was a nice night to sit out there." Her husband Marvin added that he was glad to be out in the fresh air. Tim Hack came down from Underwood for the show. "I'm disappointed, but it's okay," he said. "We're out and about in the fresh air, and I think other people are happy to go out on a nice night." The turnout, despite the windy weather, shows the demand for similar events. "Overall, it was a great night, and people told us they wanted more events in our public parks," Cruz said. The attached image shows a hot air balloon partially inflated during the celebration, with a large gathering of people walking around. Our next article is Local Scout Troop Sells Cookies to Help Homeless Animals Find New Owners by Timothy Rower. Through the efforts of a local Girl Scout troop, Humane Pet Services will be in for a treat. So too are those enjoying the cookies behind a donation drive. The troop based the Micah House Shelter are wrapping up cookie sales this week, with a portion of their proceeds going to Humane Pet Services to help connect homeless animals with loving homes. "We started selling cookies on February 9th, and it has been going good," said Sam O'Brien, child program specialist at Micah House. "About 1,700 boxes have been sold already." O'Brien said that $1 for every 5 boxes sold is going to the company, which operates an adoption center. "The animals adopted out by the business are rescued from shelters where they risk being killed if they aren't adopted in a timely manner. As of last Saturday, about $340 has been raised for the cause. O'Brien said. Donations to support Heartland Family Services can be made through the troop as well. The troop held a cookie booth at Micah House at 1415 Avenue J on Saturday morning for customers to pick up orders or purchase cookies on the spot. Our final cookie booth will be held Thursday from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Cookies can also be purchased by going to the Micah House website and to the Girl Scout cookie section via the Girl Scout cookie app or by looking up the Micah House Facebook page for more details. Girl Scout cookie season runs through Sunday. The cost is $6 per box and there is free shipping for those who purchase between 8 and 12 boxes, a $10 value, O'Brien said. The troop doesn't offer home deliveries. Micah House is an emergency shelter serving families and women in the Omaha and Council Bluffs metro area who are facing the crisis of homelessness. The agency established a Girl Scout troop in 2018 after a local official heard about one that got started in New York. The troop annually sells cookies to support itself and assist a charitable cause. At the present time, 4 or 5 girls living there make up this troop, O'Brien said. It gives them a sense of community, she said. It gives them fun things to do with other girls in the same situation. It offers a safe space for them. The pictures included in this article showcase a Girl Scout with Troop 64224 at the Micah House helping customers at a cookie booth event Saturday, March 16th. A Girl Scout who is staying at Micah House shows off cookies to Child Program Specialist Sam O'Brien during cookie booth event Saturday, March 16th as well, is the next photo. The third photo shows the cookies themselves, Thin Mints, a popular favorite. And on to our next article. PetSmart Charities this week celebrates 30th anniversary. Midlands Humane Society, Mariah Garcia. In partnership with PetSmart Charities and to celebrate its 30th anniversary of helping connect people and pets, Midlands Humane Society will bring adoptable pets to PetSmart in Council Bluffs this week in support of National Adoption Week. PetSmart Charities National Adoption Week can be the perfect chance to give a pet in need what they need most. People to love, said Heidi Marston, Director of Pet Placement at PetSmart Charities. With so many shelters across the nation struggling to keep pace with the number of animals in need of care, adopting a new pet makes an impact on the health of your community, too. PetSmart Charities National Adoption Week is a special time during the year. PetSmart stores feature adoptable pets to meet and cuddle in spacious areas, and staff and volunteers are on hand to make introductions and answer questions. Potential pet parents can also learn about the products and services they'll need for the best possible start with their new family members. We are so grateful to have this partnership with PetSmart Charities, said Nikki Cruikshank, Midlands Humane Society Executive Director. Having the ability to bring adoptable animals to our local PetSmart is extremely beneficial in not only bringing awareness to MHS and our mission within our community, but to also bring this mission further this mission by having another avenue that allows these deserving pets to find their second chance in life. MHS is open weekdays from noon to 6 p.m. and Saturdays from 11 to 5 p.m. Check out our available pets online by visiting our website at midlandshumanesociety.org/adopt. The MHS website also features more information on adopting, volunteering, upcoming events, and donating. Our next article is Woodbine Participating in Entrepreneurship Program by Scott Stewart for the Nonpareil. Woodbine is one of 30 communities across the nation selected for a program seeking to identify barriers preventing entrepreneurs from starting or growing their businesses. Woodbine Main Street announced it was selected for Main Street America's Equitable Entrepreneurial Ecosystems and Rural Communities Pilot Program, according to a news release. The program seeks to engage, activate, and empower rural entrepreneurial talent in that release states and is supported by Ewing Marion Kaufman Foundation in partnership with Forward Cities. Communities each receive a $5,000 seed grant and $1,500 toward professional development certification through the International Economic Development Council. The program also provides access to national thought leaders and partners, as well as opportunities to receive additional funding as the program expands. Because the program pairs grant funding and technical support, outcomes will allow more and better tools for business expansion or startups for local businesses and emerging entrepreneurs, Deb Sprecher, Executive Director of Woodbine Main Street, said in the release. Sprecher said the program will speak to the hurdles faced on a rural level. Providing opportunity and education for the next generation of business owners is a direct way for us to ensure vitality in our rural communities, Sprecher said. Woodbine Main Street is one of 51 Iowa Main Street communities designated and through the Iowa Economic Development Authority. The community received the designation in 2008 and won a National Great American Main Street Award in 2014 from the National Trust and Main Street America, recognizing its historic building preservation and support for small businesses. Those supports will be discussed with Main Street America, and representatives of the national organization will visit Woodbine in person and provide virtual programming support. Much of the current work on equitable entrepreneurial ecosystem development nationally is focused on large cities, said Matt Wagner, Chief Program Officer for Main Street America. There is a need to deliver these services to rural communities, and Main Street America is uniquely positioned to address that need to partnership with its coordinating programs. Local entrepreneurs and small business in Woodbine are asked to provide feedback through an anonymous survey, which is available at arcg.is/obKJI. Our next article is Revenue is Expected to Dip, Uptick Expected in 2025 by Revenue Forecasting Panel by Caleb McCullough for Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa's tax receipts will come in slightly lower than expected this year, but revenues will hold steady in 2025, according to the latest projections from a state panel that estimates the state's annual revenue. The projections are critical as state lawmakers begin the work of crafting a budget for the upcoming fiscal year, using the projections by the Revenue Estimating Conference to determine how much they can spend. Income tax cuts for individuals and corporations will continue to drive down revenue from those sources, but state officials expect increasing consumer spending to increase revenues from sales tax. The panel, which met on Friday, expects Iowa's total revenue to be $9.63 billion this year, a decrease of about $219 million from last year and about $120 million lower than state officials estimated in December. In fiscal year 2025, which begins in July 1st, revenue is expected to reach $9.7 billion, an increase of about 0.7% from 2024. That number would be down about $100 million from 2022, when lawmakers enacted income tax cuts that put Iowa on a path to a flat 3.9% tax rate in 2026. State lawmakers will need to use the panel's projection from December when deciding how to spend the state's tax dollars, because state law requires the lower of the two estimates to be used to create the budget. The 2025 estimate in December was $9.64 billion. Iowa Department of Management Director Craig Paulson, who sits on the estimating board representing the governor's office, said conservative spending by the Republican-led government has put Iowa in a strong financial position. Paulson said there is room to further cut taxes, which Iowa's Republican leaders have all called for. Thanks to this fiscal restraint, we think there is no reason to think the state cannot continue down the path of leaving more money in Iowans' pockets, Paulson said. In 2026, the projection gets more uncertain as two state agencies were nearly $1 billion apart in their initial projections for that year's income. The Department of Management and the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency each submit projections ahead of the board's quarterly meetings, and the panel has to reach an agreement between the two. The Department of Management predicted a 3.5% revenue increase between 2025 and 2026, while the Legislative Services Agency predicted a 5.4% reduction. The panel eventually settled on a 1% decrease estimate, which would put revenue that year at $6.9 billion. Paulson said he expects a larger increase as the economy continues to grow. Jennifer Acton, the Fiscal Services Director for the Legislative Services Agency, said she expects recent tax cuts and more refunds because of the way corporations are taxed to drag down the state's revenue. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the estimates show that Iowa is in a solid financial position. Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker, a Republican from Grimes, said the projections show the success of Republicans' fiscal policy and cutting income taxes. In written statements, legislative Democrats criticized Republicans for failing to pass a state funding plan for schools despite the legal deadline passing in February. The picture attached to this article showcases, from the left, Jeff Plage, Craig Paulson, and Jennifer Acton, members of Iowa's Revenue Estimating Conference, as they were seated on a meeting on Friday, March 15th. Now we move to an article by Brooklyn Drazy of the Iowa Capital Dispatch, Campus Housing Meet Increased Demand. Iowa public universities are seeing increased interest in on-campus living from new and returning students, citing convenience and satisfaction with offered service offered resources by their colleges. Iowa State University, University of Northern Iowa, and University of Iowa have all reported expecting higher numbers of students living in their residence facilities, in part due to more returning students wishing to stay on campus. At UNI, a near-record number of returning students submitted housing contract renewals, about 15% more than last year, a news release stated. At total, UNI is predicting around 3,200 students will choose to live on campus, almost 3% more than its current occupancy and the highest number since 2018. UNI Assistant President and Iowa Executive Director for Housing and Dining, Nick Raffinello, said the university housed 3,114 students according to its fall census, and its capacity is 3,594. In a recent presentation to the Iowa Board of Regents, he said the university is expected to be at close to 90% occupancy this fall, the highest since 2016. Raffinello said he's heard from students anecdotally that convenience and access are drivers behind the decision to live on campus, from dining options to custodial services and on-call aid for maintenance problems or other issues. Iowa State University housed just over 10,000 students in the fall. Vice President for Campus Life and Director of Residence Michael Harwood said in the Board of Regents meeting, "That's about 96% of the university's capacity. ISU is seeing increased interest in on-campus housing, especially from returning students, prompting the college to shift some rooms from single to double occupancy. High numbers of returning students wanting to live on campus and record numbers of admissions applications have led the University of Iowa to keep Mayflower Residence Hall open another year while keeping it on the market for sale. More than 1,500 students have applied to live on campus another year," UI spokesperson Steve Schmechdeek said in an email. "The UI expects to have enough space to accommodate all students wishing to live on campus," Schmechdeek said. The image at the top of the article shows four students sitting in a double dorm. Our final article for this section is "The Daily Iowan Saves Two Rural Papers from Closing," by Mark Moran of the Iowa News Service. The University of Iowa's daily newspaper has purchased two small-town papers as part of an attempt to keep local news alive in rural Iowa, while at the same time giving university journalism students more real-world experience. Experts who studied the practice of journalism said the acquisition might be the first of its kind. The university's student-run newspaper, The Daily Iowan, bills itself as an independent student paper with an audience of about 50,000 people, run by 100 student employees. It just bought the Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun and the Solon Economist. Richard Watts, director of the Center for Community News at the University of Vermont, which analyzes the impact of student-run journalism operations, he said it could be a solution to shore up local news deserts. "Across the country, we're losing two newspapers a week," Watts said. "It's a tremendous crisis. Some 80 million Americans have no source of local news." Watts argued well-run student newspapers, owned by universities, adhere to the same rigorous editorial and ethical standards as standalone journalism operations, and contended investing in local papers that would otherwise fail is an important place for colleges and universities to invest, and it could serve as a model for other places facing a loss of local news reporting. Watts said that universities have the staff, space, and resources to keep local papers and information outlets alive in news deserts, not just in Iowa, but across the country. "Many colleges and universities are located in rural areas," Watts said. "There's 1,316 college campuses that are located in a news desert or adjacent to a news desert. So that's 1,300 college campuses with some institutional strength that could step in and address this." The Solon and Mount Vernon Lisbon papers, both within a half hour of the University of Iowa City campus, have historically covered local news, which the publisher said will now be able to continue. Terms of the deals were not disclosed, but the money came out of the Daily Iowan's operating budget. Reminder, you're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 19th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Maggie from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Now we will begin the obituary section on page A9. July 10th from 1949 to March 8th, 2024. Merle D. Green died on the 8th of March at Ascension Living Via Christi Village in Manhattan, Kansas, at the age of 74 years, 7 months, and 27 days. Merle was born July 10th, 1949 to Virgil and May Green in Moorhead, Iowa. He was raised in Pisgah, Iowa, graduated from West Harrison High School in 1967, then served in the United States Army until honorably discharged in 1971 as an SP-5. He moved back to Iowa after a short period of time working down south and soon began his 28-year career as a carrier for the Council Bluffs branch of the United States Postal Service. Merle wed the love of his life, Merle L., in 1975. They welcomed a son, RJ, in 1985, followed by a daughter, JJ, in 1987, and moved to Underwood, Iowa shortly after. He medically retired from the USPS in 2001 due to congestive heart failure. Merle spent his retirement years with friends and family, moving to Macomb, Missouri, then to Council Bluffs, Iowa, and finally Topeka, Kansas. Merle enjoyed volunteering for many organizations throughout his life, most notably the Underwood Optimist Club, Underwood Athletic Boosters, and First Christian Church. He founded his local community, Prime Square Activities Group, where they would play daily card games and have special breakfasts and lunches throughout the year. He dedicated his life to service for many organizations and touched multiple lives. He is preceded in death by his wife, Mary Green, his parents, Virgil and May Green, brother Alan Green, sister-in-law, Carol Ann Green. He is survived by his children, R.J. Green of Draper, Utah, and J.J. Green of Topeka, Kansas, his brother Larry Green of Orson, Iowa, sister-in-law Karen Green of Tylertown, Michigan, and other loving family and friends. Visitation will be held at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home on Thursday, March 21st from 5 to 7 p.m. and funeral service on Friday, March 22nd at 10:30 a.m. Merle will be laid to rest with wife Mary in the Garner Township Cemetery with a lunch in to follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center in Walnut Hill Cemetery. The family would like to direct memorials to a scholarship fund in lieu of flowers. The address of the funeral home will be 545 Willow Avenue, Council Bluffs. Our second obit will be for Kathy Simmons, who was born June 6, 1947 and died March 13, 2024. Kathy Simmons, born June 6, 1947 in Atlantic, Iowa, peacefully passed March 13, 2024 in Council Bluffs. A loving and devoted wife, mother, and grandmother. Born in Atlantic, Iowa, Kathy spent most of her childhood growing up on the farm and attended a one-room country schoolhouse. Kathy met Bob, the love of her life, while working as a hairdresser. They married and raised their four children in Buffalo Grove, Illinois. They shared 56 wonderful years of marriage. For many years, Kathy devoted her time supporting her kids in anything they pursued, being Bob's baseball team's biggest fan and playing tennis and later pickleball. She was an amazing cook and loved baking cookies for the troops and baking muffins for her kids and grandkids. Kathy just loved her dogs and cheering for the Iowa Hawkeyes. She made friends and evoked smiles wherever she went. Kathy was preceded in death by her parents, Ruth and Wilbur Knopp. She is survived by her husband, Bob Simmons, their four children, Jennifer, Sia, Callie Wilkinson, Grady Simmons, Tyler Simmons, seven grandchildren, her sister, Sherry Kluver, and brother, Ron Knopp. Memorial services will be at 12:30 p.m. on Saturday, March 23rd at Schmidt Family Funeral Home at 1804 East 7th Street, Atlantic, Iowa, 50022. With Reverend Kyle McBee officiating. Following the service, refreshments will be served in the community room of the Schmidt Family Funeral Home. Visitation with family present will be from 5 to 7 p.m. On Friday, March 22nd, 2024, at the Bentry Golf Club, 23579 Highway 6, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Midlands Humane Society in Kathy's name. They may be mailed to the Schmidt Family Funeral Home, P.O. Box number 523, Atlantic, Iowa, zip code 50022. Schmidt Family Funeral Home of Atlantic is caring for Kathy and her family at this time, and condolences can be sent at www.schmidtfamilyfh.com. Next, Jannie Kennedy, who was born November 18, 1936 and passed away March 17, 2024. Jenny M. Kennedy, age 87, passed away peacefully at Northcrest Living Center, March 17, 2024. She was born November 18th of 1936 to Francis and Charlotte Lewis in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Jenny graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School with the class of 1954 and retired from State Farm. She was a member of the Council Bluffs Optimist Club and Toastmasters. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, Arthur Kennedy, son, Edward Kennedy, grandson, Nathan Kennedy, sister, Diane Rogash, brother, Kenneth Lewis. Jenny is survived by her children, Doreen Mowry and Ben Kennedy, grandchildren, Crystal. Fetter, Kayla Jackson, Colin Kennedy, Megan Flair, Ryan Kennedy, great-grandchildren, Connor Mowry, Bronx Fetter, Richard Arthur Fetter, Hezekiah Fetter, Emmanuel Fetter, Aiden Flair, Caitlin Flair, Emma Flair, Hector Dean Kennedy, Hope Kennedy, Piper Kennedy, Aaliyah Jackson, and Renly Jackson, siblings-in-law, nieces, nephews, cousins, and a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Wednesday, March 20th at 2024. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Thursday, March 21st, 2024. Interment is in Hazel Dell Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. The address for the funeral home is 1221 North 16th Street, Council Bluffs, Iowa, zip code 51501. Our next obit is for Susan Green, who was born May 24, 1955, died March 15, 2024. Susan Green, age 65, a lifelong resident of Council Bluffs, Iowa, passed away peacefully March 15, 2024. She was born May 24, 1955, to Robert and Bonnie Green in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Susan graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1973. She had one son, Scott. She enjoyed spending time with her son and family, especially holiday dinners at her sister Sandy's house. Susan was a friend to everyone and would try to help anyone she could. She was preceded in death by mother Bonnie Jacobson. Susan is survived by her son, Scott, her father, Robert Green, her sister, Sandy Burmeister, brother Keith Green, mother and father-in-law Brenda and Bill Bassett, and many nieces and nephews. Celebration of Life will be Thursday, March 28th, 2024, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Elks Lodge. The family will direct memorials. Our final obituary for today is for Dale Eugene Robinson, who was born April 6, 1956, and died March 15th of 2024. Dale Eugene Robinson, age 67, born to William and Lorna Robinson on April 6, 1956, in Omaha, Nebraska. Dale lived in Honey Creek, Iowa, and passed away on March 15th of 2024 at Jenny Ed Hospital in Council Bluffs. He was a graduate of Omaha North High School. Dale worked alongside his dad at Robinson's Garage and took over the business in 1987 till he sold it in 2011. He is preceded in death by his parents, William and Lorna, wife Deborah Robinson, brothers Douglas Robinson, Denny Robinson. He is survived by his children, Gabe Robinson, Danielle and husband, Douglas Walters, Heather and husband, Matthew Obama, Stevie and husband, Aaron Hubbard, grandchildren, Tanner, Alexis, Austin, Drew, Kylie, Kelsey, Ty, Kinley, Logan, Carly, and Camden, and a host of other family. Service will take place Thursday at 11 a.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment, Grange Cemetery in Honey Creek. Visitation Wednesday, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Bayless Park Chapel. The address for the funeral home will also be 545 Willow Avenue, Council Bluffs, 322-7779. We will now move on to the sports section on page C2. Our first article is Omaha's CHI Health Center preps for first NCAA tournament in 6 years by Dan Chrysler of the Omaha World Herald. Around 10 a.m. Monday, around two dozen crew members were at work laying down the NCAA men's basketball tournament court at the CHI Health Center in downtown Omaha. Having begun the job nearly 3 hours earlier, the crew worked quickly and efficiently, perhaps serving as an example of the experience the event center has had in hosting big events. 8 teams are slated to arrive Wednesday. The event center will host the first 2 rounds on Thursday and Saturday. If Brandon McCarville's words are any indication, the hosts are perhaps just as excited as the teams for the games to begin. "There's something special about March Madness," said McCarville, the assistant athletic director of facility operations and events at Creighton University, which uses the arena for its regular season men's basketball games. "It has been 6 years since the CHI Health Center hosted the NCAA basketball tournament. The 20-year-old arena has periodically hosted NCAA basketball tournaments dating back to 2008. CHI Health Center had been slated to host a portion of the 2020 tournament, but the onset of the COVID-19 pa- pandemic canceled that year's event. Since then, McCarville said officials have been preparing for this year. This planning really started back in 2020 when we found out we would host the first and second rounds this year, McCarville said. He noted there has been a lot of coordination with the City of Omaha, hotels, and the Omaha Airport Authority. 5 of the 8 teams scheduled to play in Omaha will fly in, he said. Fans of at least a few teams could opt in for a road trip. 3 teams, Iowa State, South Dakota State University, and Drake University, play their home games at campuses less than 250 miles from Omaha. I've heard a lot of Iowa State fans are coming, McCarville said. We're obviously excited to have Drake head coach and former longtime Creighton assistant coach Darren DeVries back in the building. And we also have some other staff at South Dakota State that are going to be here as well. The NCAA tournament is projected to be a big economic generator for Omaha. According to a Visit Omaha spokeswoman, the tournament's economic impact is projected to be about $7 million over a 5-day period from Wednesday through Sunday. Teams are scheduled to arrive on Wednesday beginning at 10 a.m. that day. Fans can come in to view teams' open practices, which start at 11 a.m. at no cost. Each team will get about 1 hour on the court. There won't be any autograph opportunities. In a change since last time the CHI Health Center hosted the tournament, game tickets and payment for memorabilia and concessions will all be digital. The arena also has a clear bag policy. At the end of the day, we are looking to provide an experience to these student athletes, these coaches, and these fans that's going to be second to none across the country, McCarville said. They're going to remember Omaha. The picture for this article also shows workers as they install the 2024 NCAA Division I men's basketball tournament court inside the CHI Health Center in Omaha on Monday, March 18th. Our next story is Iowa State blitzes Houston in second half to win Big 12 title. Kansas City, Missouri. Keshawn Gilbert wrapped up a spectacular Big 12 tournament for Iowa State with 16 points, and the 7th-ranked Cyclones blitzed number 1 Houston to begin the second half Saturday night, allowing them to roll to a 69-41 win and their 6th championship in 6 appearances in the title game. Milan Mamaklovic had 18 points, and Hayson Ward scored 13 for the Cyclones, who have beaten 5 different programs to raise the trophy, including Oklahoma, which at the time was led by current Cougars coach Kelvin Sampson. He probably felt even worse than he did in 2000. Iowa State turned a 30-23 lead at halftime into the kind of blowout Sampson has rarely experienced with an 18-3 run to start the second half. That gave thousands of Cyclones fans that paint Kansas City red and yellow every March plenty of reasons to stand on their feet and roar their approval. Doesn't seem to matter who is coaching them either. TJ Otzelberger is the 4th coach to win the tournament for Iowa State. Jamal Sheed had 10 points on 3 of 7 shooting for Houston, which was outscored 39-18 in the second half. LJ Cryer was held to 7 points and Emmanuel Sharp to 5 as the Cougars shot 4 of 22 from 3-point arc and 15 of 56 from the field. Our next article is Caitlin Clark's final NCAA tournament to begin at home. Can she be as prolific as she was last year? Caitlin Clark and Iowa will begin their bid to return to the NCAA Women's National Championship game at home Saturday against Holy Cross or UT Martin, as published by the Associated Press. Caitlin Clark and Iowa will begin their bid to return to the NCAA Women's National Championship at home Saturday against Holy Cross or UT Martin. Clark, the NCAA Division I career scoring leader, was prolific in last year's NCAA tournament. She posted the first 40-point triple-double in men's or women's tournament history and broke the single tournament records for three-pointers and points. The Hawkeyes, who have a 29-4 record, are the number 1 seed in the Albany 2 region, which also includes number 4 Kansas State, number 5 Colorado, number 3 LSU, and number 2 UCLA. Iowa split 2 games with K-State this season, losing 65-58 in Iowa City and winning 77-70 in a Thanksgiving tournament in Florida. The Hawkeyes beat Colorado 87-77 in the Sweet 16 last year and lost to LSU 102-85 in the title game. Iowa hasn't played UCLA since 1991. Louisville also in Albany 2, Iowa beat the Cardinals 97-83 in a regional final last year with Clark going for 41 points, 10 rebounds, and 12 assists. Clark begins the tournament with 3,771 points, which ranks 8th among men's and women's college players on any level. Clark could crack the top 5 with a long run in the tournament. Clark has announced she will skip her final season of eligibility and enter the NWA draft in April. She is the presumptive number one pick by the Indiana Fever. The photo for the article showcases Caitlin Clark as she waits with her team for the NCAA college basketball team's seed reveal during Selection Sunday at their watch party Sunday, March 17th at the Carver Hawkeye Arena in Iowa City, Iowa. Our next article details new developments in the New York fraud case against Donald Trump. Headline, Trump can't cover bond. Attorney General says she could try to seize assets during appeal by Michael R. Cizak by the Associated Press. Donald Trump's lawyers told a New York appellate court at Monday that it's impossible for him to post a bond covering the full amount of a $454 million civil fraud judgment while he appeals, suggesting the former president's legal losses have put him in a serious cash crunch. Trump's lawyers wrote in a court filing that obtaining an appeal bond in the full amount of the judgment is not possible under the circumstances presented. Trump claimed last year he has fairly substantially over $400 million in cash, but back-to-back courtroom defeats have pushed his legal debt north of $500 million. Citing rejections from more than 30 bond underwriters, Trump's lawyers asked the state's intermediate appeals court to reverse a ruling requiring that he post a bond covering the full amount to all enforcement while he appeals the judgment in New York Attorney General Letitia James' lawsuit. Trump appealed Judge Arthur Engoron's February 16th ruling that he and his co-defendants schemed for years to deceive banks and insurers by inflating his wealth on financial statements used to secure loans and make deals. If the appeals court does not intervene, James can seek to enforce the judgment starting March 25th. James, a Democrat, says she will try to seize some of Trump's assets if he's unable to pay. With interest, Trump owes the state $456.8 million. That amount increases almost $112,000 each day. Together, he and co-defendants, including his company, sons, Eric and Donald Trump Jr., and other executives, owe $467.3 million. To obtain a bond, they would be required to post collateral covering 120% of the judgment, or about $557.5 million, Trump's lawyer said. Trump maintains that he is worth several billion dollars, but much of his wealth is tied up in his skyscrapers, golf courses, and other properties. Few underwriters were willing to issue such a large bond, and none would accept Trump's real estate assets as collateral, his lawyers said. Trump's lawyers said freeing up cash by offloading some of Trump's properties in a fire sale would be impractical because such cut-rate deals would result in massive, irrecoverable losses. In a court filing last week, Senior Assistant Solicitor General Dennis Phan urged the full appellate panel to reject what he dubbed the defense's trust us argument, contending that without a bond to secure the judgment, Trump may attempt to evade enforcement at a later date and force the state to expend substantial public resources to collect the money he owed. Our next article also talks about how this is the holy month for Muslims. Around the world, faithful observe Ramadan with charity, worship, fasting, and feasting, by the Associated Press. Muslims around the world are observing the holy month of Ramadan with worship, charity, dawn-to-dusk fasting, and nightly feasts. Muslims gather for prayers inside mosques in Indonesia, Kashmir, Pakistan, and Turkey. They gather outside at New York's Times Square and in the Gaza Strip. Messages recognizing Ramadan light the sky in Turkey and Germany. Volunteers distribute food to people breaking their fast in Pakistan and Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. In Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, Muslims eat a sunset meal at a mosque. Ramadan this year comes as the Middle East remains inflamed by the ongoing Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, and many in the enclave are going hungry. Even where food is available, there is little beyond canned goods and the prices are high. Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar and begins with the sighting of the crescent moon. For many of the world's 1.8 billion Muslims, fasting began March 11th after an announcement from officials in Saudi Arabia, which is home to the holiest places in Islam. Muslim communities may start Ramadan on different days due to declarations by multiple Islamic authorities around the globe on whether the crescent moon has been sighted or different methodologies used to determine the start of the month. Photos for this article show various groups of people praying in mosques and going to prayer. Also on the national level for the Associated Press, ex-Flyers star Simmons retires. In Philadelphia, former Philadelphia Flyers star Wayne Simmons announced his retirement Monday, ending a 15-year career that included NHL All-Star Game MVP honors. Simmons, who played in 18 games last season for the Toronto Maple Leafs, will sign a ceremonial one-day contract with the Flyers and be honored by the franchise during an April 13th game against the New Jersey Devils. Simmons blossomed into a durable star for the Flyers after he was acquired from the Los Angeles Kings in a 2011 trade. He scored 203 goals over his 8 seasons with the Flyers. It's hard to describe my emotions on a day like this, but one of my very first thoughts as I look back is my life in Philadelphia and playing for the Flyers, Simmons said. Taking the ice in a Flyer sweater is a special feeling, and it's one that I'm truly proud of. The history of this franchise and standard of being a Flyer that was set is unique and one that I hold in the highest regard. Simmons scored a hat trick in the 2017 All-Star Game to earn MVP honors. He was the first Black player to earn an All-Star Game MVP award since 1986. He was one of several Black players who helped form the Hockey Diversity Alliance in 2020, creating another avenue in the NHL to fight racism and intolerance in the sport. The 35-year-old faced his share of discrimination over his hockey career. In 2013, a court in Czech Republic banned 8 fans from a stadium for 1 year for racially abusing Simmons when he played there during the NHL lockout. Simmons was entering his third season with Los Angeles in 2011 when someone threw a banana on the ice during an exhibition game in London, Ontario. The man was fined $200. Simmons was a finalist for the 2017-18 Mark Messier NHL Leadership Award and won the award in 2018-19 when he split the season between Philadelphia and Nashville. Simmons had a career 263 goals and 526 career points in 1,037 NHL regular season games in 15 seasons with Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, New Jersey, Buffalo, and Toronto. He scored 8 goals and 22 playoff points in 53 career playoff games with the Kings, Flyers, Predators, and Maple Leafs. He skated in his 1,000th NHL regular season game in 2022 with Toronto. He was originally selected by Los Angeles in the second round of the 2007 NHL draft. Simmons represented Canada at the 2008 IIHF World Junior Championship and at the 2013-2017 IIHF World Championships. Our next article for today will return us to the beginning of the Perel. As lawmakers push major bills as end draws near, by Kayla McCullough of the Lee Gazette Des Moines Bureau. After a key deadline passed last week in the Iowa legislature narrowing the bills eligible for consideration, lawmakers are turning their attention to a smaller pool of legislation and beginning the work on tax and budget policy. Last week was the second funnel week at the Capitol, where House bills needed to pass out of a Senate committee and vice versa in order to remain alive for the rest of the session. Leaders have other tools to keep bills alive that have not met that requirement, though. While several high-profile bills died in committee, many others remain alive and will get more consideration in the coming weeks. Bills to reorganize the state's boards and commissions, change election deadlines, and regulate consumable hemp products are all among the bills that remain eligible for consideration. Friday marked the end of the session's 10th week. April 16th is the 100th day and the target end date for this session, though the session often goes longer than anticipated. Area education agencies. The biggest piece of unfinished business on lawmakers' agenda is the proposal to overhaul the state's area education agencies, which provide special education support to school districts around the state. Governor Kim Reynolds proposed the bill at the beginning of the legislative session, but it has taken a winding path through the lawmaking process as it has met resistance even from lawmakers within her own party. Reynolds' initial proposal called for school districts to receive their full state and federal special education dollars rather than that funding being sent to AEAs. The schools would then have the option to contract with the AEAs or a third party to provide education support for students with disabilities. The bill would also have directed funding for other education services that currently go to AEAs to school districts and cut a property tax stream that funds the AEA's media services. The bill would also have salaries for beginning and veteran teachers. After tabling Reynolds' proposal, House Republicans wrote their own plan to change the AEA structure and oversight, keep AEAs as the sole provider of special education support, and phase in changes over a few years. House Maker Laws passed that bill in February, but the Senate did not take it up for consideration. The Senate has passed an amended version of Reynolds' proposal out of a committee, but has not yet taken a floor vote on the bill. Lawmakers will need to bridge the significant gap between the two proposals in order to send a bill to Reynolds' desk to be signed into law. House Speaker Pat Grassley, a Republican of New Hartford, told reporters on Thursday that he has been having regular conversations with Senate leaders and the governor on the proposals. "Right now, we're having good conversations," he said. "We feel pretty strongly that whatever we do with AEAs, we've been very clear in the House. We wanted to continue to provide certainty for special parents and students and school districts." Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker, a Republican from Grimes, said his members have had a variety of concerns about the bill, but that he believes Senate Republicans are close to coming to a consensus. "Our bill is vastly different from the governor's original bill. It's vastly different than the House, and so that's what makes it a little bit harder," he said. "We've got to get our own bill off the floor, hopefully soon, to really start that conversation to see where it ends." Reynolds' office on Friday shared a Des Moines Register op-ed by two school superintendents arguing for changes to the AEA system. Reynolds has pointed to national test scores lagging behind other states to argue the AEA system is in need of reform. "The system must provide transparency and accountability to school districts, those closest to our students, and drive consistency across the AEA regions to improve services for students with disabilities," Reynolds said when the House passed its bill. "That's what I've heard from over 100 school districts as I've traveled the state, and I look forward to more conversations as the legislation moves forward." Democrats have repeatedly called for Republicans lawmakers to slow the proposal down and form a task force to study the issue before making any major changes to the system. The proposal is complicated by the need for lawmakers to pass a bill setting the K-12 school funding level for the coming school year, which lawmakers have not yet done despite being required by law to pass it in February. The House has passed a bill to increase school funding by 3%, but Senate has not passed any school funding proposal. Legislative leaders said those two issues are dependent on one another and must be decided on together. Both Grassley and Whitaker said they hope to get the funding passed soon. School districts were required to submit their draft budget statements to their county auditor on Friday, despite not receiving concrete funding amounts from the legislature.